This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So what I was thinking of talking about tonight was, what kind of practice do you want to have? How do you organize the practice? What actually brought you to the practice in the first place? Sometimes we get into the rhythm of showing up, and particularly in this kind of venue where there's a bunch of different people who come through, listening and taking some stuff in and maybe rejecting some stuff. And maybe this is the whole practice. We don't have much of a practice at home. How then do you begin a practice at home? And that pulls us back into the question of, what is it actually that you want to get out of the practice, or what drew you to a practice in the first place? For me, the thing that brought me was stress. I was in a constant state of stress, and I couldn't handle it very well. And I had heard that meditation was useful for stress. And I also, at that time, was kind of prickly, and distrusting of people, and very distrusting of people in authority. And so it was hard to find somebody I could relate to in a way. So finding a teacher was difficult. I sort of thought of myself as a Dharma orphan, and thought that it might be possible to get everything I needed from books. And I like to read. I probably read 2 or 3 hours a day just for enjoyment. And so I can, you know, burn through material. That's not an issue for me. And so I started reading, and mostly I was reading Trungpa Rinpoche and that Shambhala stuff. I had started my meditation practice years earlier. In high school, I went to high school in the 60s, and transcendental meditation was the big venue. Then it was also $400. This is 60s dollars, you know, like, that was quite a bit. You could buy a brand new Cadillac for $4,900, right? And they wanted $400 for the mantra TM, which I didn't have, and my parents would not give me. So I actually went to Northwestern University, which is in the town that I grew up in, Evanston, Illinois, and hung around the coffee shop until I could talk somebody into giving me their mantra, which worked out okay. All my friends in high school kept the secret. It was really annoying. So it worked all right with developing concentration. When I spent a while hitchhiking around, and Ram Dass's Be Here Now came out, and I used that as a manual for a while, but it was very hit or miss, and I couldn't get very deep in the practice, and so when I came out here 20 years ago, I went to Ordinary Dharma, and I actually took a introduction to meditation class at Ordinary Dharma, which is in Venice, and started meditating, and sort of got involved in that community, but then again found that my difficulty in keeping relationships interfered with that, and I got into a conflict with the teacher and withdrew from that. And then I had another 5 or 6 years of just floating around as a Dharma orphan. By this time I had gotten some tapes to go with the books. And but I kept getting stuck in my practice. I'd get to a place where I had a question that I didn't know the answer to. I couldn't find the answer in a book, or if I could find the answer in the book, I couldn't figure out exactly what they meant or what to do about it. And so I again began to look for a teacher, and I got a copy of Buddhism in America. Have you seen it? It's a catalog of all of the Buddhist centers in the country, and I went through it. And it basically, what it was a blurb for every. They just sent out requests for blurbs from all of the different centers, and I went through the book, and I found a blurb that sounded exactly like what I was looking for, and as it turned out, it was exactly what I was looking for. So that was kind of cool. It was for Shinzen Young's organization, and I started to sit with Shinzen. I've been sitting with him probably for 15 years now. He teaches a kind of secular Buddhism, so all of the issues about having to believe something I didn't have, because he doesn't require any of that, and the techniques were easy to do, which is also useful for me. I like things that are simple and also are very effective. One of the things about being skeptical about all of these things is that it needs to work, and if it doesn't work relatively quickly, then it, in my mind, it doesn't work, and I move on. And one of the things about jumping from system to system, or teacher to teacher, or concept to concept, is that you keep dancing along the surface and you never actually go very deep. And the stuff that I wanted to resolve was going to be pretty deep. So when I went to ordinary Dharma in 20 years ago or so, in the first class, the teacher asked, "Why did you come here? What do you want to get out of your practice?" And I said, and I wasn't being cavalier at the time. It was really a sincere desire. I said, "I wanted to be enlightened." What I meant was, I didn't want to suffer anymore, and I wanted all my problems to go away. This was my understanding of what enlightenment was, that once you're enlightened, you have no problems and nothing bad ever happens to you. This turned out not to be true. So he suggested I have a more reasonable goal, and I'm not sure myself that I like that. I tend to like unreasonable goals, like reducing stress. So in my own experience of this, people come in, they need to get rid of stress, they need to manage better, that's the idea. Then they get a handle on stress. Meditation is incredibly effective for getting a handle on stress. You can do that pretty easily. You do that, and then you see off in the distance happiness. And you think, I'll go for happiness. And meditation is really good at happiness. And so off you go to happiness. And then you get happiness and realize, having gotten it, that it won't be enough. And then you look off in the distance, and there's freedom. And so off you head toward freedom. And actually, as it turns out, freedom is enough. And at least that's my experience of this progress that you get into. My other experience is that because the process of this can be so unbalancing, that it's very important that you have people around you that can understand this process as you go with it. We're all householders. So, you know, if you're in a monastery and you have to completely come apart into pieces, it's easier to do there than it is when you have to get up and go to work, and if you have kids, take care of the kids, or whatever it is that you do in your householder life. So there's more of a balancing act out here than there is in a monastery. So I find it's very useful to have some people around you. So Sangha is very important. As you spend time here, listen to the voices of the people that you hear. Identify the ones that you think might be useful to you, that you might be able to relate to, and then, you know, sort of mosey over and introduce yourself. It would be nice if we were all open-hearted and could welcome these kinds of introductions because we are also going to need them. And so there's a kind of mutuality to there. It's also, I think, useful to have a regular dialogue with the teacher, so however you want to work that out. I, like I said, but came kind of from a crap childhood and had issues with all people in all situations. So that required some work. So, and I'm also a list breaker. So having had such a bad experience with one teacher, I made a list of the things that I wanted in a teacher, and I think maybe I'll read it because maybe it'll be useful to you. Someone who is far enough ahead of me on the path so that he or she can handle what comes up for me, but not so far ahead that I can't understand what they're talking about. Does that ever happen to you? Yeah. Somebody sits here and they talk and you hear every word and can't understand a thing. Someone who has an active practice and is making progress down their own path. Someone who is consistently and reliably kind. I cannot overestimate how important that is to me. One little act of cruelty and I'm out the door. Someone who I can make a strong empathetic connection to and with whom the compassion necessary to maintain the connection comes easily. So, someone who's accepting of my authentic self as I am now without the expectation that I change into someone else. Someone who is an expert at what he or she is teaching. Someone who will relate the direct experience of their own progress down the path to my progress on my path without dogma. Someone who describes the world in a way that I can understand and relate to without a lot of transliteration. It's very important to me that they speak in a language that I understand and that their experience is something that I can understand directly. I don't like metaphors that much. Someone who maintains sila. Sila, do you know sila? Ethics. I came from a family with lousy sila, let me put it that way. And so that's very important to me. I like to be in safe environments. And one of the things about Against the Stream that I like so much is that the code of ethics here is really, it's very plain. Everybody's required, in, if they're teaching here, to maintain sila, and if somebody steps over the line, it's addressed immediately, so that there you can have a confidence in the quality of sila here, which I find very important. If you want to read the teacher code of ethics, it's on the website. Someone who can maintain solid teacher-student boundaries and has a sense of humor about the endless testing students tend to put their teachers through. I am one of those testers. What I like about Shinzen is that he doesn't really engage in any of it, which is very pleasant. It's often you know, you can be so seductive and then really horrified that they're seduced. It's really important that also. And someone who is reasonably available and easy to get a hold of when I need help with my practice and in whose instruction I can afford over the long haul. So, I like to have a direct a dialogue with a teacher, I find that very useful. One of the problems that we have as a community, particularly as it grows, is that we probably don't have enough teachers to be able to engage directly in conversation with them. I know my teacher has so many students that he doesn't really keep the thread of a conversation going, even for a few days. So that if you call him up, you can have an in-depth conversation, but it's just that conversation. It doesn't extend to another conversation, to another conversation. And that works very well for some people, but I don't care for that as much. So I prefer to have a dialogue with a teacher who, you know, is more continuous, more regular. He also lives in Vermont, and I live here, and that also doesn't work so well for me. But everybody's different. You have to figure out what's going to work for you and what's going to make sense. Around here, we have this model that is very common in our culture, which is that teachers come in and they do a presentation and there really isn't any access to them. One of the things that's great about this place is that actually you can encounter the teachers more regularly than that. And if you want to, some teachers here are available for an ongoing dialogue. What we're doing in terms of my availability is on Wednesday nights here, we're doing a deepening your practice evening so that you can come in and have an ongoing dialogue without having to engage more formally in a relationship with me, which I do, but I'm kind of at the limit of the students that I can work with. Where do you want to go with your practice? Is another question. We talk about the three marks of existence, anatta, anicca, and dukkha. Are you familiar with them? Anatta, not self, anicca, impermanence, and dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. People often come in oriented around that sort of thing. If you have a lot of suffering and you're trying to relieve suffering, then you're probably coming in through the dukkha or unsatisfactory door. I notice in my work as a teacher that we have kind of two ends of the bell curve. You know what a bell curve is? Kind of looks like that. Distribution of population. On one end of the bell curve are people that don't function that well, that have a lot of suffering, that are trying to organize and get it together. On the other end of the bell curve are people that function really well and have gotten most of the things that they've gone after, but that they're still unsatisfied, still unhappy. Everybody else in the middle seems to be still chasing the golden ring, and so they don't have time for this. They're not motivated to do it. The people that I encounter, maybe 2/3 of the people I deal with are looking at reducing their suffering. So they're coming in through that particular view of it. And that's what the initial work is about, relieving suffering. The other quarter are functioning pretty good and are looking for a straight path to liberation. And that's also a great way to go. So you have to size up where you are, since it isn't one size fits all. It's, you want this organized around you and what you need. And then look at the practice around organizing practice so it actually begins to meet your needs directly, so that you make progress in a reasonable amount of time. If you don't tend to make progress in a reasonable amount of time, it becomes frustrating. And you begin to imagine that the meditation practice is not actually going to be able to do what it is you want, and then perhaps you move into some other practice or some other thing to do. So it may actually be that it just requires this organization or tweaking, which is actually pretty one of the reasons why the dialogue with the teacher is so useful, because they can sort of hear what you're saying because they're further down the path. They can make recommendations. I know when I first met Shinzen, he made a recommendation to me, and I diligently pursued it. I really am one of those people who wants to be a good boy, you know, And so if you tell me to do something, I tend to do it unquestionably until it doesn't work the way I thought it should, and then I come enraged back to you. Go left. Off I go left. Then I come back, I report all the progress I'm making, and he says, go right. And I go, that's completely contradictory. First you tell me to go left, then you tell me to go to right. You don't even know what you're doing. And he says, well, at that moment, well, you're on a path. It's a straight path. On one side is a cliff. On the other side is a river. I'm trying to keep you walking down the path. It seemed like you were heading into the river, so I told you to go left. Then it seemed like you were going off the cliff, so I told you to go right. Neither one is contradictory. Actually, both of them were perfectly good advice. So that's actually the purpose of the teacher, just to say, go left or go right. I also was very outer directed in a way. It was very hard for me to hold my own center. And so it was useful to have a teacher who could stand in as a center, a secure base, so that it was safe for me to explore as I developed my own sense of security around that. So it's another useful quality of a teacher. What else can I think of to say about that? It's about seeing. We all can see, in a way. But it's about understanding what we're seeing. And sometimes it's very difficult to do that. So it's useful to have a sounding board. You describe what you're seeing, what you think you're seeing, and then somebody else that you can rely on also expresses what they see and experience.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.